English Listening Comprehension Test, Autumn 2004, Advanced Level. This test is in four parts. Part 4 has separate directions. Now, in parts 1, 2, and 3, you will answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the correct alternative answer according to what you have heard. Mark each answer on the optical answer sheet. The test is about to begin. You will hear part 1 twice. First, listen to it straight through.
It was Sunday, May 26th, around 7:45 a.m. A boat, actually a barge loaded with wheat, ran into a bridge. It was the four-lane Interstate 40 bridge over the Arkansas River near Weber Falls, Oklahoma. The bridge collapsed into the river and 10 vehicles went into the water before traffic was stopped. Here's Robert Smith with a story of what happened.
The events actually began the previous morning as a towboat and two barges left Fort Smith to go upstream for a load. And then at 6 a.m., almost 2 hours before the accident, something else occurred that was to play an important role in the events. A fishing contest started, just up the river a bit. 17 boats were in the water, all looking for largemouth bass. Two of the fishermen were 75 yards north of the bridge when the sound of a terrible crash caused them to turn around. What they saw was incredible. One barge was against a bridge pillar, and the bridge itself was collapsing with a car and a truck on it. The men said that section of bridge came down like it was in slow motion. And then more cars kept coming off the bridge. The men jumped up and down in the boat, waving their hats, but no motorists saw them. One of the fishermen picked up a signal rocket in the boat and shot it up toward the break in the east end of the bridge. It went off right in front of a truck. It stopped. The driver of the truck screeched to a halt with his front tires at the very edge. He then backed up about 15 feet. On the east end of the bridge, traffic stopped behind him, and on the other side, several cars and trucks fell into the river right in front of Max and Goldie Alley's van. They realized that they were about to fall, too. Their wheels bumped over a break in the bridge, then Max Alley slammed on the brakes. The airbags filled. He barely managed to stop, and the traffic behind him stopped as well. When there were no more vehicles coming over the sides, the fishing boats moved in for rescue attempts. It had been about 5 minutes since the barge hit the bridge. One of the trucks that flew off into thin air had a husband and wife team in it, Jean and Richard Cawley, who'd been married for over 40 years. According to Jean's cousin, Richard wouldn't even go to the store without kissing his wife goodbye. Suddenly, Jean screamed, "My God, there's no road!" Over they went, and the truck sank with both inside. Richard managed to get his seatbelt loose, but he couldn't free Jean. Her seatbelt was stuck tight. Then he had to go to the surface for air. He doesn't remember how many times he dived for Jean. Too tired to dive, too tired to fight the swift current anymore, he finally floated helplessly along. That's where he was found a few minutes later. Father and son, John and Bill Swain, moved their fishing boat in. With its 200-horse motor, it could hold steady against the strong current. That's when they saw a hand sticking out of the water. Then Richard Cawley saw them. They threw him a rope. Cawley missed. Twice. Then he caught hold. The Swains pulled him aboard by his shirt collar and the seat of his pants. Cawley had a terrible wound in his arm. Bill used his belt to stop the blood flow and his shirt to cover the hole. When asked later if it was hard to react, Bill Swain said, "When the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City blew up and the World Trade Center in New York City, I wondered if I could do things. No question. Yeah, you can do it."
Now, listen to the same story in five sections. Look at questions 1 and 2.
It was Sunday, May 26th, around 7:45 a.m. A boat, actually a barge loaded with wheat, ran into a bridge. It was the four-lane Interstate 40 bridge over the Arkansas River near Weber Falls, Oklahoma. The bridge collapsed into the river and 10 vehicles went into the water before traffic was stopped. Here's Robert Smith with the story of what happened.
The events actually began the previous morning as a towboat and two barges left Fort Smith to go upstream for a load. And then at 6 a.m., almost 2 hours before the accident, something else occurred that was to play an important role in the events. A fishing contest started, just up the river a bit. 17 boats were in the water, all looking for largemouth bass.
Answer questions 1 and 2, then look at questions 3 and 4.
Two of the fishermen were 75 yards north of the bridge when the sound of a terrible crash caused them to turn around. What they saw was incredible. One barge was against a bridge pillar, and the bridge itself was collapsing with a car and a truck on it. The men said that section of bridge came down like it was in slow motion. And then more cars kept coming off the bridge. The men jumped up and down in the boat, waving their hats, but no motorists saw them. One of the fishermen picked up a signal rocket in the boat and shot it up toward the break in the east end of the bridge. It went off right in front of a truck. It stopped.
Answer questions 3 and 4. Look at questions 5 and 6.
The driver of the truck screeched to a halt with his front tires at the very edge. He then backed up about 15 feet. On the east end of the bridge, traffic stopped behind him, and on the other side, several cars and trucks fell into the river right in front of Max and Goldie Alley's van. They realized that they were about to fall too. Their wheels bumped over a break in the bridge, then Max Alley slammed on the brakes. The airbags filled. He barely managed to stop, and the traffic behind him stopped as well. When there were no more vehicles coming over the sides, the fishing boats moved in for rescue attempts. It had been about 5 minutes since the barge hit the bridge.
Answer questions 5 and 6, then look at questions 7 and 8.
One of the trucks that flew off into thin air had a husband and wife team in it, Gene and Richard Cawley, who'd been married for over 40 years. According to Gene's cousin, Richard wouldn't even go to the store without kissing his wife goodbye. Suddenly, Gene screamed, "My God, there's no road!" Over they went, and the truck sank with both inside. Richard managed to get his seatbelt loose, but he couldn't free Jean. Her seatbelt was stuck tight. Then he had to go to the surface for air. He doesn't remember how many times he dived for Jean. Too tired to dive, too tired to fight the swift current anymore, he finally floated helplessly along. That's where he was found a few minutes later.
Answer questions 7 and 8. Look at questions 9 and 10.
Father and son, John and Bill Swain, moved their fishing boat in. With its 200-horse motor, it could hold steady against a strong current. That's when they saw a hand sticking out of the water. Then Richard Cawley saw them. They threw him a rope. Cawley missed. Twice. Then he caught hold. The Swains pulled him aboard by his shirt collar and the seat of his pants. Cawley had a terrible wound in his arm. Bill used his belt to stop the blood flow and his shirt to cover the hole. When asked later if it was hard to react, Bill Swain said, "When the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City blew up and the World Trade Center in New York City, I wondered if I could do things. No question. Yeah, you can do it."
Answer questions 9 and 10. This is the second part of the test. In this part, you will hear 10 short dialogues. Each one involves a different situation with different speakers. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 11.
Sam, did you see the aftershave ad on TV during the evening news?
Yeah, I went right into the bathroom and splashed some on. Shouldn't I start seeing girls crawling through the windows and breaking the doors down? Don't you feel the magnetism?
That's lame. You, a victim of advertising, no such thing is happening. And you haven't got the right brand of aftershave on anyway.
Answer question 11. Look at question 12.
Did you read that most British 11-year-olds can't spell simple, everyday words?
What? I thought that that was being taken care of.
Well, apparently it isn't working. About half of all school children can't spell things like passenger or expensive. Most couldn't spell extremely.
But didn't the Education Secretary set up a system where school kids get an hour of literacy teaching every day, where they get training in spelling?
Oh, yes. But it doesn't seem to be working. The system is going to be extended from the 11-year-olds to the secondary schools, starting next year.
Well, that makes sense.
Answer question 12, then look at question 13.
How do you think the FBI teaches its operatives the science of investigating murders?
I don't know. How?
Well, here in the magazine, it says dollhouses.
No wonder they never get it
no,
right.
No, actually, the statistics for crime solving are pretty good. Well, actually, the dollhouses are just models which can be carried around from seminar to seminar. They're developed for hands-on training.
Well, that almost makes sense, but it's a bit odd.
Answer question 13. Look at question 14.
The latest statistics in from France are very revealing.
You don't say. What are they?
Well, a new survey shows that the French see nothing childish in comics.
Really?
Yes. The survey shows that 44% of readers who follow the adventures of Lucky Luke the Cowboy are graduates.
Yeah, I know that here in Britain, even many teachers read comics.
Answer question 14, then look at question 15.
Have you heard about the washing machine that talks to you?
Yeah, I read about it, too. You just stick in your socks and T-shirts and tell it to pre-wash at 40 degrees Celsius, then spin at 1,400 revolutions and start in half an hour.
I know. Because there are so many options, what with the programs and cycles and so on, you can actually ask the washing machine questions.
And it'll answer you back. You don't even need to look at the instruction manual.
But hey, most people simply want to throw their clothes in and choose a cold or warm or hot wash. Nothing more.
Answer question 15, look at question 16.
There's been quite a slump in passenger numbers ever since the big train crash at Hatfield.
I know. I could have taken up 3 seats this morning, and it's been quite a while since Hatfield.
Well, 4 deaths scared quite a few people away from the railways. 4 lives that could have been spared if the authorities had only looked at that rail in time. Now traffic is down by millions.
And the accident investigation revealed that the rail had been cracked for quite some time before the crash. They're not sure for how long. It hadn't been inspected often enough. Can you imagine? But they're sure that many, many trains have passed over it before it broke. How many? No one knows.
Answer question 16, then look at question 17.
I'm reading here about Rusty Haight, a human crash test dummy.
That sounds stupid.
No, he's actually a highly paid professional. It says that in addition to teaching police and insurance accident investigators, he's a consultant for the motor companies on car safety. For example, they made changes in airbags after one cut his arm. And he's proud he's completely redesigned the baby's car seat. He's already crashed over 700 cars, sometimes 30 or 40 a day.
That's too much.
Answer question 17, look at question 18.
Jean, did you notice that street robbery is up by some 7%?
No, I hadn't.
And gun crime has gone up 37%. You know, shop robberies at gunpoint and that sort of thing.
That's shocking. I mean, what with the strict laws on gun ownership? I'd have thought it would have gone down.
No, quite the contrary, even though many fewer guns are being sold.
Yow, that's really off the wall.
Answer question 18, then look at question 19.
You know those electronic fat analyzers?
You mean the little electronic gadget you stick between your fingers and it measures your body fat?
Yeah, just the thing. Well, don't expect to get the gospel truth out of it.
What do you mean?
The distortion level on them is 70%. You'd get a better estimation by taking your T-shirt off in front of your mother.
I'll say. I think I'll save my money and not buy one.
Answer question 19. Look at question 20.
Did you hear what 350,000 A-level students received a couple of weeks back?
No. What?
Well, in the same envelope with their acceptance letters to universities, they received letters from the BBC telling them that they must have their own telly licenses when they go to university. Failure to pay out could result in a £1,000 fine.
You must be joking.
No. The letter even says, "Won't you be under enough pressure at university without having to iron a shirt for a court appearance?"
Good grief.
Answer question 20. This is the third part of the test. You will hear this part twice. Listen to this part straight through.
This morning, we have Anne Foxwell with us to talk about a French farmer.
Thank you, Nigel. Yes, I have a story about a French farmer, Philippe Laurent, whose family farm is found in northern France, near the Belgian border. Philippe Laurent, let me call him Philippe, states that Europe has the best system in the world to allow a region to be self-sufficient in food. They don't have to import any food at all. He thinks that in order to achieve these good results, other parts of the world should organise their food production in the same way. And in reality, taxpayers in several European Union countries, for example Spain and Greece, tend to back Europe's farm support programmes because they get more from the common agricultural policy than they give. But much of the rest of the EU, led by Britain and Germany, are screaming for change. Last April, the US, Asian and Latin American farming nations blamed the EU for being pig-headed in negotiations to settle on cuts in agricultural subsidies. One can gasp at the hypocrisy of the Bush administration's lecturing about agricultural protectionism after approving a $190 billion support bill for US farmers. But most neutral observers agree that the EU was the principal villain. Australia, in particular, is pressing for a free market agriculture policy. But Philippe defends the current system, emphasizing that he couldn't survive in a free global market. He doesn't have to, so he really doesn't know. The current system ensures that his beef and red beetroot are kept artificially cheaper than imports from Brazil, and that keeps him satisfied. And there is an idea which is backed by Brussels that Philippe and his wife should diversify their income, perhaps by turning part of their home into a bed and breakfast. But Philippe says that he really likes his peace and quiet. His farm embodies traditional French rural values. It's set in a valley about 10 miles from the Belgian border. But it's not remote. There are huge slag heaps, hills of ugly leftover rocks and debris from decades of mining operations, starting on the other side of the village. Behind the hills is Lille, the largest industrial and commercial centre of northern France. And where does Philippe's farm income come from? Well, 40% is directly from Brussels. Every March he has to submit a mountain of paperwork. That he doesn't appreciate. The following November, the claim is approved by Brussels, and then the aid checks start arriving. The farm doesn't earn anything. The expenses of running the place take all of the income, all of the subsidies and the sales of crops and the beef, even a bit more. Were it not for Philippe's wife, who is a poorly paid schoolteacher, they wouldn't have anything to live on. That is, the couple and their three young children. Philippe owns 3 hectares of his farm. The rest is rented from 22 landlords. And that is for a farm that totals 23 hectares. That's about a landlord per hectare. Each one gets a cheque at the end of the year. The reason for this is the centuries-old inheritance tradition in France, with farms being divided into ever smaller bits of land among the members of a family. Another problem is that the land is divided into 18 sections, none of which border on the other. Much of Philippe's working day is spent herding his cows along the narrow lanes around the village, from one field to the next. But he sees a rosy future for his farm. After all, it's for farmers like him that the EU's Common Agricultural Policy was created.
Now listen to the same discussion in 5 sections. Look at questions 21 and 22.
This morning, we have Anne Foxwell with us to talk about a French farmer.
Thank you, Nigel. Yes, I have a story about a French farmer, Philippe Laurent, whose family farm is found in northern France, near the Belgian border. Philippe Laurent, let me call him Philippe, states that Europe has the best system in the world to allow a region to be self-sufficient in food. They don't have to import any food at all. He thinks that in order to achieve these good results, other parts of the world should organise their food production in the same way. And in reality, taxpayers in several European Union countries, for example Spain and Greece, tend to back Europe's farm support programmes because they get more from the Common Agricultural Policy than they give. But much of the rest of the EU, led by Britain and Germany, are screaming for change.
Answer questions 21 and 22, then look at questions 23 and 24.
Last April, the US, Asian and Latin American farming nations blamed the EU for being pig-headed in negotiations to settle on cuts in agricultural subsidies. One can gasp at the hypocrisy of the Bush administration's lecturing about agricultural protectionism after approving a $190 billion support bill for US farmers. But most neutral observers agree that the EU was the principal villain. Australia in particular is pressing for a free market agriculture policy. But Philippe defends the current system, emphasising that he couldn't survive in a free global market. He doesn't have to, so he really doesn't know. The current system ensures that his beef and red beetroot are kept artificially cheaper than imports from Brazil, and that keeps him satisfied.
Answer questions 23 and 24. Look at questions 25 and 26.
And there is an idea which is backed by Brussels that Philippe and his wife should diversify their income, perhaps by turning part of their home into a bed and breakfast. But Philippe says that he really likes his peace and quiet. His farm embodies traditional French rural values. It's set in a valley about 10 miles from the Belgian border. But it's not remote. There are huge slag heaps, hills of ugly leftover rocks and debris from decades of mining operations, starting on the other side of the village. Behind the hills is Lille, the largest industrial and commercial centre of northern France.
Answer questions 25 and 26, then look at questions 27 and 28.
And where does Philippe's farm income come from? Well, 40% is directly from Brussels. Every March he has to submit a mountain of paperwork. That he doesn't appreciate. The following November the claim is approved by Brussels and then the aid checks start arriving. The farm doesn't earn anything. The expenses of running the place take all of the income, all of the subsidies and the sales of crops and the beef, even a bit more. Were it not for Philippe's wife, who is a poorly paid school teacher, they wouldn't have anything to live on. That is, the couple and their three young children.
Answer questions 27 and 28. Look at questions 29 and 30.
Philippe owns 3 hectares of his farm. The rest is rented from 22 landlords. And that is for a farm that totals 23 hectares. That's about a landlord per hectare. Each one gets a cheque at the end of the year. The reason for this is the centuries-old inheritance tradition in France, with farms being divided into ever smaller bits of land among the members of a family. Another problem is that the land is divided into 18 sections, none of which border on the other. Much of Philippe's working day is spent herding his cows along the narrow lanes around the village, from one field to the next. But he sees a rosy future for his farm. After all, it's for farmers like him that the EU's Common Agricultural Policy was created.
Answer questions 29 and 30. This is the fourth part of the test. There are 5 sections. Each section is a separate story. You will hear each section twice, and then you will have time to answer that section. Then you will go on to the next section. You will write in Finnish or Swedish. You must write your answers on the special answer sheet. Read question A. Question A, listen to this section.
My first day on my new bike, a Harley-Davidson V-Rod. I had 8 hours to enjoy, and I only climbed off for a total of 2 breaks of 5 minutes, for you know what. I sailed for miles past the Pacific Ocean, winding up and down deserted side roads, almost running over a snake. Oh, the glorious sun! It reminds me of the Sahara. Taking all day to get nowhere has never been this much fun. The Porsche-designed water-cooled engine with all-new exhaust system is so quiet you can almost hear the birds singing.
Now listen to this again and then answer question A.
My first day on my new bike, a Harley-Davidson V-Rod. I had 8 hours to enjoy, and I only climbed off for a total of 2 breaks of 5 minutes, for you know what. I sailed for miles past the Pacific Ocean, winding up and down deserted side roads, almost running over a snake. Oh, the glorious sun! It reminds me of the Sahara. Taking all day to get nowhere has never been this much fun. The Porsche-designed water-cooled engine with all-new exhaust system is so quiet you can almost hear the birds singing.
Read question B. Question B, listen to this section.
And a little note from history. The most famous mint of coinage in the era of Queen Elizabeth I was a Frenchman, Eloy Mistrel. He had learned coin making at the French mint at Versailles. By the time he arrived in London in 1559, he had a criminal record for forgery. But Queen Elizabeth I gave him a pardon of all crimes committed before coming to England. And then she put him to work, operating Britain's first machine for minting coins. The reason for this action by the Queen was to overcome a financial crisis caused by the widespread circulation of fake silver coins in the realm. His work pleased the Queen, but finally, his criminal past caught up with him.
Now listen to this again and then answer question B.
And a little note from history. The most famous mint of coinage in the era of Queen Elizabeth I was a Frenchman, Eloy Mistrel. He had learned coin making at the French mint at Versailles. By the time he arrived in London in 1559, he had a criminal record for forgery. But Queen Elizabeth I gave him a pardon of all crimes committed before coming to England. And then she put him to work, operating Britain's first machine for minting coins. The reason for this action by the Queen was to overcome a financial crisis caused by the widespread circulation of fake silver coins in the realm. His work pleased the Queen, but finally his criminal past caught up with him.
Read question C. Question C, listen to this section.
For the last 40 years, tens of thousands of Volkswagen Beetles have dominated Mexico City's taxi service. The Beetles are cheap and can squeeze through tight spaces, but their air-cooled engines are big polluters, and without rear doors on the cars, it's easy for a crooked cab driver to trap and then rob his passengers. Now authorities are offering money to get rid of the beetles for cleaner running and safer four-door small cars.
Now listen to this again and then answer question C.
For the last 40 years, tens of thousands of Volkswagen Beetles have dominated Mexico City's taxi service. The Beetles are cheap and can squeeze through tight spaces. But their air-cooled engines are big polluters, and without rear doors on the cars, it's easy for a crooked cab driver to trap and then rob his passengers. Now authorities are offering money to get rid of the Beetles for cleaner running and safer four-door small cars.
Read question D. Question D. Listen to this section.
Everyone is cut into their finger while slicing bread or carving a piece of beef. Well, fear no longer. Nathan Clark has created Talos. Talos is a two-fingered glove made of flexible plastic. Just slip the thumb and index finger of your non-cutting hand into it and grab your knife. Slice away. Cut them up. You won't gash your hand or stab yourself.
Now listen to this again and then answer question D.
Everyone is cut into their finger while slicing bread or carving a piece of beef. Well, fear no longer. Nathan Clark has created Talos. Talos is a two-fingered glove made of flexible plastic. Just slip the thumb and index finger of your non-cutting hand into it and grab your knife. Slice away. Cut them up. You won't gash your hand or stab yourself.
Read question E. Question E. Listen to this section.
Stephen Thoburn, a 36-year-old greengrocer, will appear in the magistrate's court next week. His crime? Selling 1 pound of bananas. Not 454 grams, or even half a kilo. You see, this is against the metric law, designed to bring Britain into line with a European directive. Mr. Thoburn is likely to receive a £5,000 fine, but he says he will refuse to pay.
Now listen to this again and then answer question E.
Stephen Thoburn, a 36-year-old greengrocer, will appear in the magistrate's court next week. His crime? Selling 1 pound of bananas. Not 454 grams, or even half a kilo. You see, this is against the metric law, designed to bring Britain into line with a European directive. Mr. Thoburn is likely to receive a £5,000 fine, but he says he will refuse to pay.
This is the end of the test. You will now have 8 minutes in which to blacken with a pencil the ovals indicating your answers and to check the written answers. Remember to make sure you have written the following information on your answer sheet, your name and number, and the name and number of your school. Also, make sure that the information needed for the exam has been carefully marked in. Thank you.